A bill that seeks to overhaul higher education and ban DEI training has passed the Ohio Senate, and some members of the House want to push for a vote there. Could college protests over the war in Gaza be the reason some Republicans withhold support for the measure? This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our Friday News Review, we'll talk about that bill and other news from Columbus. We'll also discuss whether Cincinnati City Council could put an income tax increase on the November ballot. We'll hear why a Cincinnati university that's been open for more than half a century is shutting down. And now that it's been nearly a year since Ohio lawmakers expanded the state's school voucher program, we'll look at what that's meant for private school enrollment. We've got a lot to talk about today. Here to get us started is Ohio Public Media Statehouse News Bureau reporter and producer Joe Ingles. Welcome back, Joe. We've missed you.
Thank you for having me, and I've missed y'all too.
Well, I mentioned some Republicans in the Ohio House are working to see if they can force a floor vote on this bill to overhaul higher education. It's already passed the Senate. Talk about some of the provisions in the bill that make it controversial for some folks.
Well, it goes after DEI, which is diversity, equity, and inclusion training, and that's being used on college campuses. It's used in a lot of businesses. It's you know, DEI is basically everywhere. But some of the lawmakers do not like DEI training because they feel like it violates, you know, people in a way, makes them feel uncomfortable, that kind of thing, and is against their values. So they have come out with this bill that passed the House initially. It is a House bill. It passed the House. And then last year when it went to the Senate made some changes to it. They passed it with the changes. It got sent back over to the House, and it is kind of set there ever since because they haven't picked it up and done anything with it. Now the people you were referring to, some people trying to get it going. One of those is one of your representatives, Representative Bill Seitz of Cincinnati, is one of those trying to get that piece of legislation before the full House for a vote because they wonder if there's enough votes to pass it. So they're working on that behind the scenes right now. We have 1 week left of session before summer break. That's this coming week. And will it be on the floor is the question.
And these lawmakers, including Representative Bill Seitz, they're trying to force a vote on this bill on the floor because the House Speaker just hasn't brought it forward. I mean, is that the issue?
Yes. The House Speaker, you know, there's been a big fight in the House over who got to be Speaker and who wasn't. So we've got one Republican in charge of the Republican caucus, and then we have the House Speaker who was elected with the help of Democrats. So he doesn't necessarily speak for all of the Republicans. So there is this thought that Speaker Jason Stevens is holding this back somehow and that there are the votes for it to bring it to the floor, to force it to the floor. So that's what they're trying to do, is figure out how many Republicans want to vote for it. Because if all the Republicans vote for it, it passes, Lucy. But the thing is that I'm talking to some of the Republicans. And even though some of the Republicans, like, for example, Representative Jay Edwards, he says, you know, the thrust of the bill, getting rid of DEI, he's okay with that. But he said the problem is that for some Republicans, they're really worried that the bill just goes too far and could have some unintended consequences.
And how do protests over the war in Gaza figure into all this?
Well, that's one of the things. If you remember in the spring when OSU had the protests, the president there, President Ted Carter, he came out with a way to kind of quell those protests, you know, kind of keeping things in check. But those some of the Republicans are thinking those run, you know, counter to the elements of this bill. And they're like, well, maybe you'll tie the hands so that a university president cannot peacefully deal with this like President Carter did, because he was the Republicans, at least in the legislature, liked the way he handled it. And so they want to make sure that they're not, you know, doing something that is going to come back to bite them later.
And how much time do lawmakers have to get this done? Do they have to get it done before they break for summer?
No, they don't have to get it done before they break for summer, but they're going to have a long break. What's going to happen is they call it summer break. I call it summer and fall break because what they're doing is they're after this week, they'll be off the rest of the summer, and then they're off until after the November election. So when they come back, it's going to be, they're only going to have a few weeks to get a lot of legislation dealt with. And so it could very well get lost in the shuffle. It could be combined with other bills. Any number of things can happen during what we call the lame duck session. And that's basically between the last of the General Assembly. This is the last year of this General Assembly. And it's between the November election and the end of the year. And this lame duck session, we're told it's going to be wild. So, something like this that's hanging around, who knows what would happen to it? Would it get lost in the shuffle and not get passed at all? Would it get passed in a different way? There are some people who would just like to pass it and get it out of the way now.
And you mentioned this is the last year of this General Assembly. Am I right that that means that any bill that doesn't pass before the end of the year, it would have to start all over next year because it's a whole new 2-year General Assembly, right?
That's right. You go back to the start position with every single bill. So anything that doesn't pass by the end of this year, it has to start all over again with the next General Assembly in January.
Well, let's move on. We had more news this week related to the bribery and corruption scandal involving House Bill 6, the nuclear power plant bailout law. Tell us about these text messages that date back to 2018.
Well, okay, there's two former FirstEnergy executives who have been charged with crimes. And this kind of came out of their defense. And basically, they had their attorneys had asked for a lot of material. And now some of the texts released from FirstEnergy show that then candidate DeWine and John Husted, his lieutenant governor, were working to try to get campaign cash to beat then candidate Rich Cordray for the governor's position in 2018. And as they were out there getting the money, they solicited a $500,000 from, well, they got more, but in one time they solicited a $500,000 from FirstEnergy. So there is a paper trail of texts that seem to indicate that Governor DeWine was trying to get this money for his campaign. And when reporters asked him about this, he was saying, "Well, I go after a lot of campaign contributions. That's what politicians do." And kind of makes you wonder how many $500,000 donations do you get? But anyway, he got this. They did give him, FirstEnergy gave him this $500,000 campaign donation that went to this dark money group associated with the Republican Governors Association. And that's coming up now because they're looking at the defense of Chuck Jones and Mike Dowling, who are two former FirstEnergy execs, and that's being pulled in. The governor, of course, is saying, there's no wrongdoing. So.
Okay, so this is when Mike DeWine was running to win his first term as governor. He
Right.
there's this text saying that, hey, I need this money, and the campaign contribution from FirstEnergy, this $500,000, went to this dark money group, not directly to the DeWine campaign, but went to this dark money group connected with the Republican Governors Association. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes, correct. And if you remember right, during that campaign at that time, it was neck and neck. I mean, the next governor's race with Nan Whaley, there was more of a margin. But back in 2018, Richard Cordray was doing really well in the polling with Governor DeWine, and Richard Cordray had just gotten a big teachers union to donate him with some money right before this donation was made. So, it's all about the money. Who can get those ads out there? Who can get their message out there? And when you're in a tight campaign, the dollars count.
Why is Governor DeWine saying voters should trust him about this?
Well, he's saying, you know, he was asked, you know, why should we trust you when you say that you don't, you know, have any wrongdoing here? And he said, you know, I've got 45 years. I've been in politics for 45 years. You know me. I've been in the state house. I've been in the U.S. Senate. You know what you're getting. And, you know, he's saying his reputation is the reason that voters should, you know, believe him, that he really didn't have anything to do with this corruption that's associated with HB6.
Yeah, we want to make it clear that Governor DeWine hasn't been charged with any crimes in relation to this.
Yes.
Would it have been legal for him to solicit contributions for his campaign for the dark money group?
No, that's where it comes in. He can get campaign donations for his own campaign. I mean, everyone does that. But candidates are not supposed to be affiliated in any way with dark money groups. They're supposed to be a separate firewall there. And so if he was coordinating with a dark money group, that would be a problem.
Well, and as I said, you know, Governor DeWine hasn't been charged with any crimes, but some powerful people have been convicted in this House Bill 6 scandal, and others have been indicted. Kind of run through that list a little bit for us.
Yeah, it's a list, a long list. But, you know, the most notable is former House Speaker Larry Householder. Larry Householder is serving a 20-year prison sentence right now after being convicted of racketeering and bribery in connection with House Bill 6. We've also, the Ohio Republican Party chair at that time, Matt Borges, he has been convicted of the same thing. He has 5 years that he's serving right now. We have seen a couple of people who have been charged in connection with the House Bill 6 that charges were levied against, but they're no longer with us, and they have passed away since then. One of them was Neil Clark. He is a former lobbyist, very well known. He committed suicide, and also the former head of the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio, Sam Randazzo. Sam was basically, you know, in charge of overseeing everything with the public utilities. And he was charged with some crimes, but never made it to trial.
Hmm. What's next with all this, this whole case?
Well, that's a good question. Right now we're seeing, you know, it's so complicated. There's so many prongs to it, but we are seeing the first energy executives being readied for trial. We are seeing the state come out and bring charges against Larry Householder in particular, because Larry Householder, if he's trying to appeal his federal conviction, and if he is successful in appealing that conviction, then maybe he'd get out of office. And if he got out of office, he could actually run for the Ohio House again.
If he got out of prison, you mean?
Yes, if he got out of prison. Why did I say office? Sorry, guys.
That's okay.
I'm getting a little rusty here, but yeah, if he got out of prison, he could actually run for office. Hmm. And so anyway, that's a concern for the state. So the state has some charges against Larry Householder. They're working to get him convicted on some state charges so that he can't come back in and run again. And they're still, you know, they're going into HB6. That certainly is not dead at this point. But, you know, they've probably charged most of the people involved. Whether more charges will come out of it is a big question mark. But it looks like maybe they've got the biggest fish out of the pond. But I don't know.
Yeah,
we'll see. It's still open.
Yeah. We just mentioned there were a couple people charged in this case who died by suicide. I want to mention that if you or anyone you know or love is thinking of suicide or is in crisis in any way, you should call or text the National Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. That number is 988. Joe, I want to ask you about one more thing before we let you go, because I know you've got a million things to do. There's been a lot of talk about how state lawmakers want to tweak the recreational marijuana law passed by voters last November. Where do those talks stand?
talk. And at the talk level, Lucy. Basically, there are a lot of different ideas out there about how it could be implemented, rules that could be changed. Because, you know, when voters passed this, there were a lot of things that were left to the state to spell out, a lot of little details. It was basically voters passed a package, but they didn't specify everything. And the lawmakers could do that. It left it open for them. The fact is, though, that they are not all on the same page. We have seen a lot of different pieces of legislation out there to deal with parts of the new marijuana plan. Anything from how the money that's, you know, that comes from it should be generated and spent, where things should, you know, how it should be sold, you know, process questions. And so anyway, there is one plan that I talked with Jamie Callender, who was actually, he likes the idea of legal marijuana, and he thinks voters, you know, agreed on this plan and it should be, you know, put in place. But he's telling me now, he said, you know, if they don't pass it soon in the legislature, then, you know, maybe it's just best to wait until, you know, the first of next year and see how this all shakes out. Because he said the big things that, you know, a lot of lawmakers were worried about, and those are things like, can kids get their hands on marijuana as it's sold to them? Are the dispensaries close to schools? You know, things about marketing to the kids and stuff like that. He's saying that those things are being dealt with by the Cannabis Control Commission, which is the state, kind of the state arm that's overseeing all this. And because those are being dealt with, he said that maybe the better idea is to come back in January and just do cleanup with places in the law where there are still questions or problems or something like that.
And how soon could medical marijuana dispensaries start selling to recreational customers?
Well, very soon. They're all in a different stage. You know, that's kind of up to them as fast as they can comply. They've put in their applications. They'll get everything in a row. But there's a lot of things they need to do before they can actually sell. They have to comply with a lot of the rules that are being put in place with this Cannabis Control Commission. So they're going to have to go in and make sure that they are indeed complying with the rules. And then once they do that and they've been given the go-ahead, they can start selling it. So we might even see them, you know, selling it later this month. We could definitely see it, you know, at some point this summer in some of the, and not all of the medical marijuana facilities or dispensaries are going to sell recreational marijuana. That's not a foregone conclusion either. Mm-hmm. Some of them will.
Yeah. We did get an email about our previous conversation about House Bill 6. And the question is, has House Bill 6 been repealed or is it still law in the state of Ohio?
Well, it is still law in the state of Ohio. However, little portions of it have been repealed. But if you're talking, and I assume that the place of interest on this is the fees that were generated from House Bill 6. Those are still in the books. Taxpayers are still paying the fees on their bills for House Bill 6. And the bulk of it still is in place. There have been efforts to repeal it, completely repeal it, but those have kind of gone nowhere.
Hmm. Well, I have been talking with Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau reporter and producer Joe Ingles. Thank you so much for your time today, Joe.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
Up next, a group of local business leaders want Cincinnati to increase the earnings tax. What will City Council do? This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. There's a chance Cincinnati voters could see an income tax increase on the November ballot. Here to tell us all about what that is going on, what's happening with that, is WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Welcome back, Becca.
Thanks for having me, as always, Lucy.
It's always great to have you here. So Cincinnati City Council heard this update from the city manager this week about the report from the Futures Commission. Mm-hmm. I'm going to try to summarize the Futures Commission. It was this group the mayor created to recommend ways to stabilize the city budget.
That's right.
Okay. Among the report's recommendations are this pair of income tax increases. Tell us about that recommendation. What's going on there?
Yeah, so not a huge surprise to see a tax increase recommended in the Futures Commission budget. It's one of the few ways the city has to increase revenue for their budget. So the way that the Futures Commission is recommending that this happen is any income tax increase would have to be approved by Cincinnati voters, which means a ballot measure. But city council can put that ballot measure on the ballot, that tax increase on the ballot. So the recommendation is two sort of separate income tax increases. Unclear if council would put this as one measure on the ballot or two separate ones, because it could be done either way. One would be 0.1%, and that would be revenue dedicated for economic development, a way to generate more income for the city. Excuse me. The other would be 4.05%, and that revenue would be dedicated for public safety. Both of those, the Futures Commission is recommending, would be time limited to 10 years. So they would expire after 10 years. And then, of course, there could be a recommendation down the line to put those back on the ballot for another limited time or what have you.
What did council members have to say about raising the city's income tax as this group recommended?
So council has not been super clear yet on whether or not they support it. You know, the chair of the committee you mentioned that met this week and heard the update from the city administration, it's Jeff Kramerding. He's chair of the Equitable Growth and Housing Committee. You know, the soonest that council could put a tax increase on the ballot is November. And so he did ask a lot of questions about what it would take to put it on the ballot in November. But other council members, you know, and Kramerding kind of echoed this as well, say they don't want to be rushed. They don't want to feel like they are being pushed to put this on the ballot before they understand all the implications and the need. They asked a lot of questions of the city manager about the Futures Commission report. What data did they use? What data did they have access to? What did their like specific projections look like in terms of how much money these would generate, that kind of thing? Some of those questions are answered in the Futures Commission report. Some are not. So the bottom line from the update this week was there's a lot more information that needs to come in, a lot more research and some thorough vetting. So certainly no certainties for this year.
And Councilmember Kramerding, he also brought up the need for public engagement. Tell us about that.
Yeah, you know, he did specifically say he thinks the city didn't kind of fell short on public engagement in a few recent things, which we've talked about in Cincinnati Edition many times, including the railroad sale last fall. A lot of complaints about the lack of engagement or the quality of engagement there. And then more recently, Connected Communities. Kramerding didn't mention that specifically, but it's certainly been, you know, on a lot of folks' minds and something that can't be forgotten. So, you know, if council does decide to ask voters for a tax increase, that's a pretty big deal. They would obviously want that to pass. So Kramerding is kind of making the point, we don't even want to make the decision to put it on the ballot before we've had some thoughts about community engagement and coalition building was a term that he used with me, you know, really kind of figuring out what's the best way to kind of convince voters that we think this is the best thing to do for the budget before moving forward with that decision.
And you mentioned that the council members said they don't want to be rushed. What's council's deadline for deciding whether to put an income tax increase on the November ballot?
The deadline is August 7th. So council's actually on summer recess now. This meeting on Tuesday was the last council meeting before the summer recess. But council does this every year. They take a recess over the summer, but they meet once in August before returning to a normal schedule in September. So that August meeting is already scheduled for August 7th. That is the deadline for council to put an income tax increase on the November ballot. Now, not that this is necessarily going to happen, but there is a little bit of a later deadline if council were putting, say, a charter amendment or another ballot measure on the ballot for November. But this is a state law requirement. There has to be 90 days before the actual election that a tax increase is put on the ballot. But to be clear, you know, council could decide not to put it on the ballot in November, wait for a future election. There's no like real deadline as far as that goes.
Understand. Another one of these recommendations from the Futures Commission is related to redirecting some income tax revenue away from infrastructure. Tell us, what's that about? Tell us about that.
Yeah, this was a really interesting one that actually heard some talk at the Railroad Board a couple of weeks ago and then came up again this week. So basically, the Futures Commission was kind of modeled after a similar effort in the 80s called the Smale Commission. And this was similarly, the city officials were saying, hey, we need some help with our budgets, a little bit more specific to infrastructure in that case. And so this commission of business leaders and community leaders met and said, okay, one of the things we think the city should do is raise the income tax and use that revenue for current city infrastructure. Voters eventually did approve that not long after those recommendations, and that's been in place ever since. What the Futures Commission, so this current commission, has said is we think that council should change, so keep the income tax at that amount, but change some of the where that revenue goes. So redirect some of that revenue to the general fund. And the reasoning there is we just sold the railroad. There's now this $1.6 billion infrastructure fund that's bringing in investment income, and that is dedicated for maintaining city infrastructure. So the Futures Commission is saying, looks like you've got enough for infrastructure. The real problem now is with the general fund. Move some of that over. Turns out that the city law department says you can't just do that. So the recommendation was that council just pass an ordinance saying, you know, move the money over somewhere else. The city administration, in particular the attorney's office, says you can't do that. That would also need to be approved by voters and would have the similar deadline of 90 days before an election to be put on the ballot.
What did council members think of that idea? And I know that you mentioned the railroad board. You heard some feedback on that idea there, too, didn't you?
Yeah, pretty clear negative feedback on that issue at a recent meeting of the Cincinnati Southern Railway Board of Trustees. Now, of course, the board is now managing the investment fund rather than the actual railroad like they were before the city voters decided to sell it. But former mayor Charlie Lucan, who actually formed the Smale Commission back in the 80s, had some really strong words about this in the Futures report and said he was very disappointed in that recommendation. A, he thought it couldn't happen without the vote of the people, which the city attorney agrees with him on, but also said that he felt like it would be extremely disrespectful to voters because he said that he and the railroad board kind of campaigned on selling the railroad as an extra source of income for infrastructure, not as a replacement for the Smale tax, which has been going towards infrastructure as well. And he said that is not what we campaigned on. You know, it would be very disrespectful and feel like a bait and switch to voters if we did that. So there was some talk at the railroad board and other board members agreed with him, including one other former mayor. And the idea there being that if city council were to try and make that change, the railroad board might pass a resolution saying we don't want you to do this. But it seems like it's not going in that direction anyway, since the city attorney's office is saying voters would have to do it. You can't just do it on your own.
Mm-hmm. So what are you watching for next with all this, with the Futures Commission?
Well, I'd say the biggest update on the Futures Commission this week was that there wasn't much of an update. So we know the deadline if council is trying to put an income tax on the ballot for this November. But this Futures Commission report had, you know, over 25 recommendations, depending on how you count it, with sub-recommendations. So there's a lot in there, including some things that would be pretty drastic changes that administration at this point is saying, we need to study this more. We just don't have a good answer for you yet. We do expect more information, maybe not a final report, but more information in August when council meets again during that summer recess break. The city manager, Cheryl Long, has said that she expects to have a written report and some more detail at that time. So even then, though, I think there's going to be a lot of unanswered questions still. I think the biggest one is this recommendation that the city regionalize Greater Cincinnati Water Works, which would basically be selling it not to a private company, but making it a regional public asset instead of a city-specific asset. And that one, you know, Kramerding said he thinks might be 5-10 years down the road. That is, if that even happens, that would also require a vote of the people and would be extremely complicated.
Wow. Okay, well, we know you'll stay on top of everything. I've been talking with WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Thanks for your time today, Becca.
Thanks so much, Lucy.
Up next, Union Institute is shutting down after more than half a century of operations. We'll hear what went wrong. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. School's out for summer, but there hasn't been much of a break when it comes to education news. Cincinnati's Union Institute is shutting down. Cincinnati Public Schools might be reorganizing some of its school buildings, and that's just the start. Here to talk about some of these education stories they've been covering this week are WVXU education reporter Zach Carrion. Welcome back, Zach.
Good to be here.
And the Ohio Newsroom reporter and producer Kendall Crawford. Thanks for being here, Kendall.
Thank you, Lucy.
Zach, you've been following the story of Union Institute. I think it's been more than a year now. Am I right about that?
You are correct. It has been more than a
year. Maybe feels like longer than that. The big news is that it's closing. When is that happening?
So that is happening officially June 30th. So the news this week was that they had forfeited their accreditation, which is basically their ability to receive federal aid. So that's, you know, students apply for federal aid that helps pay for tuition. And it also, you know, validates their degree programs, makes them essentially a real verified institution. So once you lose accreditation, it's pretty hard to go anywhere from there. You essentially have to close. And this was basically the final step in what's been a long year for the university and a very long year for their employees and a lot of the students there.
Well, and as I mentioned, this university has been around for 60 years. How did this happen? How did it get to this point?
It came down to money and finances. If you looked at their tax forms from the past few years, you noticed that they went from, having a positive balance to kind of very quickly going from that to, millions in the hole just a few years ago. So it's been happening there for a long time. And certainly higher education right now, you're seeing colleges bring in a lot less money. So Union is certainly a part of that. But there was a lot going on as far as transparency with some of the leaders at this institution, which I think separates it from a lot of the other closures we've seen in the state and elsewhere around the country.
The U.S. Department of Education investigated Union Institute, too, right? What came of that?
So what came of that was a $4.3 million fine. And that was because of some of the accusations that were made about them misusing some of the money and also, misleading their employees about when they would be paid and how much they would be paid. So a big part of that was the federal student loans. So last summer in 2023, we had some students reach out to us and say, we haven't seen our student loan refund checks. And so what that is you get that money, that loan from the federal government. Money goes towards tuition, but you also get some of that extra money that kind of helps you support yourself while you're in school, since you can't really work full time if you're a full time student. So that money that they were supposed to receive didn't show up. And they had some questions about that, like you would if you're depending on that paycheck or that check. But the university couldn't give them full answers. A few months earlier, they had the issue with not being able to pay a lot of their employees. And if you don't get paid, why would you stay? So a lot of people left at that point. So there weren't many people working in the offices to kind of answer these questions around where that money was going. And frankly, some of the employees that I spoke to said they were instructed not to be transparent about where that loan money had gone. So we found out that the university had used that money that was supposed to be going to students to pay some full-time employees that they hadn't paid before. And the reason why they weren't paying employees at that time was they didn't have enough money to do it. So when, they were getting the paychecks ready on Wednesday, Thursday, they were doing so kind of knowing that they didn't have the money for those checks to clear. So it was compounding issues on issues and we've seen it lead to their closure and plenty of fines, plenty of lawsuits.
Well, talk about those lawsuits. There have been a couple of them, right? Are those still in process?
Yeah, so there have been two so far, and these are filed by employees that have worked there for some of them for years. And basically, these lawsuits, both of them really, are over some of the being misled by the university. Of course, they're upset about not receiving their paychecks, and certainly there's some legal violations there when you're not paying employees for the work they're doing. But also, they're saying that Karen Schuster Webb, the president, and some of the other leaders there were not being honest about how much money the university actually had. They were being told, you'll get your paychecks in full next week, including back pay. And it didn't happen. And it had happened several times throughout last year. And that's what these lawsuits are about. You know, people could have taken employment elsewhere at that time, but they believed that this university that they had worked for and trusted for so long wouldn't lie to them and actually pay them. And so that's what these lawsuits are about. So there's already been another settlement that happened a few months ago. I believe all those employees got to share like a $55,000 pot, which split between even just a couple of them. That's not even anywhere close to the wages they would have lost.
And I think you mentioned the university hasn't really been operating this year, right? It hasn't operated for a while.
Yeah, so they really haven't had normal classes in the sense of, you know, online and having instructors there since spring 2023, when kind of all these things came to light. So they didn't really have a summer semester. There wasn't really anybody working at that time. And they postponed their fall semester initially, but I think it was pretty clear to everybody around the situation that there wasn't going to be a fall semester. There wasn't enough employees to make it happen. And frankly, you know, students, it was just a mess all around. So it's been a good year since there's been any kind of regular classes there. There were some students, PhD and master students, who were trying to finish up their degrees. Some of them were not able to. Some of them were. So really, as far as like normal college operations, hasn't been the same there for at least a year.
What did Union Institute officials have to say about this? Have they talked with you about all this?
So they really have not been willing to talk to me or anybody. Every piece of information that I get from that top leadership was leaked to me by people that work there. And when this whole thing kicked off in early 2023, I was able to get Karen Schuster Webb, the president, on the phone. She agreed to do an interview and speak to me the next day. Never heard from her again, called her a few times since then. Really, she doesn't pick up the phone. I was able to speak to Tom Frederick, their vice president of academic affairs. He's spoken to me before, but I tried to do an interview with him yesterday about this. I spoke to him for a few minutes. He said he needed to ask permission. And a few minutes later, he called me back and said he can't do it. So they have wanted to kind of control this narrative around what's been going on, but the lack of transparency there has been a big issue with employees, and frankly, it's kind of hurt their image, which made it hard to get other kinds of grant funding that maybe would have helped them. But that lack of transparency and kind of secretive nature there kind of really hurt them going down the line.
Mm. Wow. Well, I guess this wraps up your coverage, at least for this chapter of Union Institute. I want to move on to vouchers now. Kendall, it's been almost a year since the Ohio legislature expanded its school voucher program, making every family eligible for money to attend a private school. What has that change meant for the number of scholarships that are awarded through this program?
It's meant a huge, huge increase. So there's been 60,000 new scholarship recipients this year. And to put that a little bit into context, the amount of private school enrollment in that same time has only gone up around 3,000%. So we're seeing a lot more families take advantage of this program, but they're not necessarily public school students. In fact, we figured out that most of them are private school families that are just taking advantage of the scholarships, even though they'd already chosen a private school.
And this is a big change from how the state's Ed Choice program used to work. Can you explain briefly how it used to work and how it compares to what's happening now?
Yeah. So before, there were income limits when you applied. So if you had to be 250% at or below 250% of the federal poverty level to be able to receive a scholarship through the Ed Choice expansion program specifically. And then the legislature last year decided to take away those income limits. So that opened it up. So now that every family can apply. Looking at one district that I talked to, like before, only around like 10% of their students would have been able to apply. And then, of course, that opened up immediately to everybody at that school district.
Yeah.
Zach, what do advocates for school vouchers think about how this change is playing out? Were they assuming that a bunch of people would leave the public schools to go to private schools?
Yeah, frankly, a lot of voucher advocates, this is kind of what they expected and kind of wanted. They wanted more students to be using these vouchers to kind of supplement that tuition for private schools. And really the reason for that is some of the people that I spoke to said it's a better value than a public education. And what they mean by that is, you know, each student in a public school system, you know, it's a certain amount of money that in the formula that they get. And if you were to compare that to, you know, perhaps the money spent on a private school, technically it's less money. And now there's other factors in that, you know, special education and students with different needs are in public schools, not necessarily in these private schools. The way that I've seen it broken down is yeah, the private school can be seen as a better value for certain students. So instead of putting that money into public schools, they're putting it into private schools, getting a better, more bang for their buck, to say.
Huh. Kendall, even if this isn't hurting enrollment at public schools, there are plenty of public education advocates who oppose this voucher expansion. Talk about why that is.
Yeah, I think the sentiment there is that they don't want to see Ohio's education funding going towards private schools if those private schools aren't going to kind of play the same ball game in terms of accountability and what kind of assessments they have to take. One of the superintendents I spoke to in a school district outside of Steubenville kind of explained it as like he has to go through all these hoops to jump through to get funding. And he saw it that private schools are just not having to do any of that. So really the complaint is that there's not the same level of accountability in those private schools as public schools. And then also just this idea of like they want the public schools to be fully funded before we even talk about vouchers at all. So until the fair school funding formula is fully met, a lot of the public school advocates I talked to specifically didn't want vouchers to exist at all.
Yeah. And again, of this 60,000 new scholarship awards that you talked about, these are, for the most part, if not all, kids who were already in private schools, not switching from public schools to private schools. That's what you all found, right?
Yeah, yeah. If you look at the number difference, it's, a lot, yeah. The majority. And all the districts that we talked to as well just kind of had that same moment where it's like, oh, there are like 500 kids in the district that should have disappeared, but our enrollment's the same or even growing.
Hmm. Okay. You know, we talked about this, what the rules that the private schools have to follow in terms of the testing, the financial transparency. Zach, are there efforts underway to make the rules the same for everybody, to kind of be able to compare how students are doing in private schools as compared to public schools?
Yeah, there is a bill that is in the House right now, House Bill 407. It was built up by Bill Seitz, who was mentioned earlier on this show today. And basically what it would do is it would kind of provide or require these schools that are receiving vouchers, I believe it's a certain percentage of students who are receiving vouchers at a certain school, they would have to be transparent about how that voucher money is being spent. So it would be need to go into things within the school district that are being utilized by students who are using vouchers. It would also require these private schools and these voucher students to take all the same tests as the kids in public school. And the idea behind this is that it would kind of give these private schools, require them to be a little bit more transparent like the public schools and just make sure that they're using this state money effectively and using it responsibly instead of taking money from the state and putting into something completely unrelated to education. So these things are in place. And, you know, while certainly public school advocates aren't in favor of vouchers, they do agree that if a voucher system is going to exist, and it appears like it will exist here in Ohio, that there needs to be some of these parameters in place to at least hold them at least somewhat in the same way that we keep an eye on private or public schools.
Mm-hmm. Kendall, an interesting part of your reporting to me, though, was that there are parts of the state where there aren't any private schools that accept vouchers, right?
Yeah, there are 12 counties in Ohio that have no private school options that participate in EdChoice expansion. So if you live in one of those counties, you likely live pretty far away from a private school to be able to utilize the program. There's also another, like, more than 60 counties that if you want a private school option, but you don't want a religious private school, that's even harder to find. So 60 counties there, you know, all the options that are available to them are a religious school.
And Zach, are there concerns about that?
Yeah, there's frankly just not a lot of private school options out in rural communities. You look at only 4% of students in rural areas are participating in the voucher program, so that's a very small percent. But even then, you know, we've spoken to private schools for that story in more rural communities. We spoke to one in Ottawa, in Northwest Ohio, and basically they don't have the capacity to bring in more students. So, you know, even though this voucher program was intended to put more kids into private schools, the space isn't there, especially outside of the big cities. There really isn't room for, even if they wanted to, for students to use these vouchers.
And I know you all reported on some ideas that school choice advocates have to work to address that, but I want to talk real quickly before we have to finish up today about the region's largest public school system, Cincinnati Public Schools. The district's interim superintendent wants the board to reorganize some of the district's schools. I know this is complicated. Can you briefly explain what the plan is?
Okay. So they have this school called Spencer Center. It's a magnet school for academically gifted students and things like that. But right now they're kind of running out of space in that current building. It's a pretty small one. So they want to move those students from Spencer to River East Academy and take the students that are the middle and high school age students at River East, move them to the second floor, and move the students, the younger students, into Mount Washington School. And eventually the students from Spencer would come in, and then the next year they would take over that whole building, and the students from River East Academy would go to other schools of their choice there. Also included with that is Schroeder High School. The 7th and 8th graders would move into the Dr. Odell Owens School building, which is a former Lighthouse building. And the students from that school, along with the Promise Center, would move into the Spencer Center building. So a lot of movement there and shuffling. But basically, they're doing this because they feel like they want to better utilize their school buildings. Riverview East Academy has kind of a lower enrollment, but a very large building. So they're doing this to kind of better utilize some of that space. And, you know, there's some savings there as well.
Yeah. And I know the school board hasn't voted on this, but is this theoretically, just even yes or no, something that could happen before the start of the new school year?
It could happen very soon. And I will say they're looking for public engagement on this. They have a special meeting Monday night at 5:30 at their central office. There is a public comment portion there. So if you want to be heard about this issue, 5:30 on Monday.
Okay. Well, I've been talking with WVXU education reporter Zach Carrion and the Ohio Newsroom reporter and producer Kendall Crawford. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Okay, you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. And we have coming up on Tuesday, we're going to be talking about rising vet bills. If you've been struggling, give us a call, 513-419-7100. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.